you know, we were camping and we would have a hotel reservation, then change it and stay somewhere else the, you know, last second, things like that, to just keep a low profile. We stayed off social media the whole time.
That's crazy, dude.
It was kind of one of those things where it's like someone says, you know, your Everesting attempt was crazy and other stuff like that. But when you work up to it and you put the work in and you do the homework, it's actually not as crazy at the time and the moment.
It's showtime, everybody! Showtime!
You've been living in a dream world, Neo. Yeah. This is the world as it exists today.
Life moves pretty fast. You don't stop and look around once in a while. You could miss it.
Listen, we're talking about practice.
Hey, Pete, on the dude's rug.
Donnie, you're out of your element.
I see. You think this has nothing to do with you.
Don't ever trash talk Black Jesus.
This is the Adventure Stash with Payson McKelvin.
Hello and welcome back to the show. This week, another adventure all-star, Eric Porter. I was first introduced to Eric via DVD way back in the early 2000s when I got Cranked 6 for Christmas. When I was first getting into mountain biking, mountain bike DVDs were one of the main things that fueled my stoke. And my parents, realizing that this mountain biking habit was a pretty healthy one, wanted to continue to promote it a little bit, I think, and support it. And they bought me a handful of DVDs one Christmas. And one of them was this DVD that Eric Porter starred in. And so ever since then, I've looked up to him and followed him. And as my career grew, eventually his and my paths kind of crossed and we got to be online friends. And then eventually we met via a Red Bull connection at one point and have stayed in touch ever since. And he's someone that I've really wanted to do a podcast with. And it finally worked out this week. Also, fun fact, for those of y'all that listened to the series with Nicole Baker in the previous weeks, Eric was actually Nicole's tent mate during that big Zanskar adventure that you may have heard about in episode 3, I believe. So it's kind of fun because Eric tells some of his side of the story of Zanskar. And if you go back, you can hear kind of Nicole's side of the story as well. Anyway, Eric is just an incredibly inspirational character in the mountain bike world. Started out as a pioneering free rider, spent quite a bit of time in the competition world, and then gradually transitioned to more of a project-based rider, a lot of media, content creation, really, really cool, unbelievable adventures. Recently, he rode his mountain bike in Iraq. This guy's just been all over the map and done a little bit of everything in the sport. Absolute wealth of knowledge. This episode is brought to you by Roll Massif, just like last week. Roll Massif is typically a really awesome series of 8 events that take place in Colorado. I had a couple on my calendar this year, but like most things in 2020, this series of events had to be canceled. But they put the Roll Massif Challenge in its place. It's a really cool virtual challenge that if you sign up for, you get all kinds of perks. So if you sign up, you get to choose 2 distances, 353 miles or 484 miles that you're working towards. Those numbers represent the cumulative miles of all of their 8 events for their short courses and long courses. And once entered, every week they will be doing prize drawings for bike computers, kits, all kinds of stuff. At the end of this online virtual competition on October 31st, there's a grand prize drawing where they're going to give away a bike and a bike rack. All you have to do is go to rollmassif.com/challenge and sign up. It's a really fun, interactive thing. I'm participating. Allie Tetrick, good gravel friend of mine, is participating. Allie's actually leading me right now on the leaderboard. I was 4th or 5th a couple days ago. Allie was 3rd or 4th, I think. But as some of y'all know, if you listened to last week's episode, I'm about to go on a big bike trip, and I think I'm about to leapfrog Allie. We'll see. So if you're interested, see where you'd stack up on that leaderboard, get a little friendly competition, plus some added perks of some prize giveaways. Go to rollmassif.com/challenge. That's rollmassif.com/challenge. And use code PAYSON20 to get 20% off registration and any of their merchandise. That's code PAYSON20 for 20% off. This episode is also brought to you by Manscaped, longtime supporter of the show. Exciting news about Manscaped. They just launched in Australia and the UK. So if we have listeners over there, Manscaped is now available there. As y'all know, I'm a big fan of Manscaped. I'm a fan of their Lawnmower 3.0, very high quality hair trimmer, uses ceramic blades, replaceable ceramic blades, waterproof body, nice bright LED light so you can see what you're doing. Super awesome unit, that Lawnmower 3.0, use it weekly. One thing of theirs that I use daily is their crop cleanser. They have a whole line of really great products beyond the actual grooming Lawnmower 3.0 and their Shears 2.0. They have some great body care products that I'm also a big fan of. If y'all would like to get your hands on some Manscaped products, give it a try. You can use code PAYSON for 20% off. Just go to their website, manscaped.com. Use code PAYSON, 20% off and free shipping. Thanks to Manscaped and thanks to Roll Massif for supporting this show. Now to Eric Porter.
I've been watching the smoke maps and looks like you guys have been really lucky down there.
Yeah, it's weird. It seems super unpredictable. Like we went on this little bikepacking trip. We thought we were going on a little bikepacking trip and there was no warning whatsoever of smoke. It wasn't even on our radar. And then we woke up the next morning and visibility was like quarter mile, half mile. It was terrible. And then,
oh, I saw that. Yeah.
And then 2 days later, it was totally fine again. So,
crazy.
Yeah. Wind dynamics. Are y'all are pretty socked in still?
You know, it comes and goes. Saturday was okay. And it kind of got worse through the day. And then it's in and out between kind of green and yellow. But when you look at the smoke plume maps, it's, we're like kind of right at the edge. And then there's this gap in the middle of like central Utah and Durango, where it looks like you're kind of not getting the northern or the southern jet streams. And, I kind of feel like during, March and April, when everyone in big cities had to stay inside, now we feel like that, where we were fortunate then to be able to go out and play. And now we're stuck inside due to something completely different.
Totally. Yeah, for sure. Well, anyway, thanks for doing this. Finally,
yeah.
We've been talking about it since basically as long as I've had the podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been listening to most of them when I have a chance and throw it on when I'm digging in the yard or whatever.
That's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess just kind of to intro things officially, I was first, this is kind of funny, but I was first made aware of you when I got, I want to say it was Cranked 6. A DVD for Christmas.
Yeah.
And so just a little backstory. When I was about 14 years old, I was in a bike shop with my parents and the film Rome was playing on the bike shop TV. And I was just transfixed. And I convinced my parents to buy the DVD there because I couldn't stop watching it while we were there at the bike shop. So I memorized Rome, got super inspired, started building little jumps in the yard, that sort of thing. And then I was like, well, I wonder what else is out there, you know? And so one Christmas, they just bought me a few mountain bike DVDs and Crank 6 was one of them. And obviously you're in that. It's just a super old school. When did that come out? Like mid-2000s?
Yeah, that would have been mid-2000s. I think I was on Haro then. So that would have been probably 2006, 2007.
Yeah.
Somewhere in there. 06 to 08. Yeah.
So for those that don't know, I mean, you're one of the pioneering free riders. You're someone who was there kind of guiding the sport and pushing the sport in new directions when free ride was just starting to take off. And this film, Crank 6, was just super inspirational to me. And so ever since then, I've, you know, been watching your stuff and keeping an eye on what you do. And fast forward, you know, coming on, what is it, 15 years or more, you're doing the same thing, similar things.
Right.
Still a professional mountain biker, despite, you know, the landscape changing a lot since then. And it's interesting to go back and see everyone that was in those films and see, you know, who's still around doing the same sort of thing and the names that have kind of moved on to different things. You know, you mentioned Ben Boyko earlier. I haven't heard his name in a while. What is he doing?
I'm not sure, actually. I think he was doing something with excavation or forestry or something like mm-hmm. that. I mean, he can do whatever he wants to. He knows how to do all kinds of stuff. He was one of those insanely talented riders and was better than everybody for a bit. And he had, he was crushing it. I think what happened to him was he had built everything and he was one of the guys that really created his own career. So he went out and built everything that he filmed on. Him and Bearclaw were the two really big ones that did that and kind of built whole trails for their video part and did everything themselves. They didn't have a crew building something for him or whatever. And so he built all this stuff. He shot on it. He basically created his own career. And then on top of filming, he podiumed and won contests. And I think he won almost everything that one year. And then he had Enders in the Anthill and the New World, like the two biggest videos at the time. And then the following year, he had a bunch of injuries and he had two video parts that the builds fell apart for whatever reason. Like one was a land issue, I think. He had everything built and ready to film and then the owner changed their mind.
Oh.
And something else. So basically he had the best year you could possibly have and negotiated hard and did really well. And because he figured he wasn't going to be around for forever. So you got to get what you can get out of it, you know, especially when you're crushing it. And then the next year, he just had a really unlucky year with injuries and all kinds of other things like that. And I think it was just hard for him to recover from. And it also, I believe, happened right as the economy was crashing. So it was, I think he got to a level where he was doing well and then kind of hit a restart button because of that bad year and just couldn't go back to making nothing to have a recovery year, you know?
Right.
And that was a tough one, but he did so much gnarly stuff.
Yeah. That guy was crazy. I mean,
yeah, I'd love to see him again, see what he's doing.
Tons of name, like Steve Romania comes to mind also. Like, I wonder what he's doing these days, that guy in those.
I heard he's DJing in Kelowna, cause he's from Kelowna and he's like partying, DJing, and no way. I guess he's doing well with it. Yeah.
That's awesome. That's hilarious. Yeah. Interesting. So when you look back on that time, some of those early, well, what was the first film that you did? What was your first project, would you say? You know, like headliner, New World Disorder style, Cranked style.
Cranked 6 would have been the first kind of big budget one. Before that, though, was the DH Productions one, which was Don Hampton, what he did. And that was the stuff that Jeff Lenoski and Aaron Chase and Kyle Ebbett were in. And those guys were the ones that really showed me how to be a pro rider, because we were all racing the Norbas at the time in the late 90s and early 2000s.
Really, and you were racing Norbas?
Yeah, so I got I was racing semi-pro downhill and trying to make it as a downhill racer. And that's actually when I moved to Durango in 2001, I think. The plan was to be a pro downhill racer and see if I could make it. And in between the races, when I should have been training, we were all out street riding and dirt jumping and having fun on our bikes, which ended up being what worked out anyway. And so Chase and Ebbett and Lenoski had already been filming that stuff for their videos and for the Chain Reaction videos. And it was starting to be a thing. And so I kind of jumped right into that and figured out somehow I was riding a little bit of BMX at the time too. And I had always been really infatuated with handrails on snowboard and on BMX. I thought that was like the pinnacle of bike riding, was if you could grind a handrail, that was the gnarliest thing you could do. Yeah. And I actually had pegs on my BMX bike, hung up a back peg, went over the bars and smashed my teeth out. So they're all fake. And so then I was like, well, screw pegs, and started doing pegless things and ended up learning how to do slide handrails on my mountain bike without pegs. And that was really what started things for me. I got a cover on Flow magazine, which was like the free ride magazine at the time. And
was that in Durango really when you were living in Durango?
It was when I was living in Durango. The rail was actually in Vegas. I remember, so that Interbike, I was walking around the trade show with a binder full of like photos, like printed photos, because there wasn't the internet like it is now.
Yeah.
And showing people like pictures of me doing this and that. And trust me, you know, I'm going to do awesome and sponsor me stuff, you know, the full talk and see what I could get. And no one had any time for me, of course. And at that Interbike, Scott Hart, who I'd raced collegiate with, he was running the magazine then. He shot a photo of me at Vegas grinding a handrail, which ended up being the cover. That's what really kicked things off then.
Yeah. Do you remember what bike you were on? Like, what was the setup? Because one thing that always strikes me when I go back and watch these DVDs is, first of all, how narrow the bars are. That's hilarious.
Yeah. 26 or 8. I think 28 inches was wide.
Yeah, yeah. So do you remember what bike you were on when you did that rail on with a pegless mountain bike?
Yeah, so it was I was riding for Iron Horse at the time, and they were giving me frames, and that was, you know, that was the extent of it, but that was all I really deserved anyway, because I didn't have anything to prove at that point, or to show for it. Yeah, so it was just a hardtail frame. It was the frame that we were all racing dual slalom on, and it was V-brakes, and I ran V-brakes for longer than most on the dirt jump bikes because of that, because there was no rotor to get in the way of the rails. And that was another funny thing is, you know, a sponsorship. I had always run Manitou at that point for whatever reason, and I broke it. Hampton gave me a RockShox. I put it on the bike and got the cover on that. And then I got a call from Joel Smith, who was running Manitou, as soon as that cover came out. And he was like, "Hey, do you have a fork sponsor?" And I mean, this is the editor, like I'd grown up reading his magazines. He was legendary, you know, still is. And so that was my first cold call sponsor call. And probably wouldn't have happened if I'd already been on Manitou anyway. But that was a funny one. And yeah, so that was the bike though. And yeah, I've got the cover downstairs. It is funny because I'm 6'3" or whatever, and looking at the bars now, I'm like riding this like looks like a fixie, like street bike or something almost.
Yeah, you're a hipster out there just totally packages.
yeah, so the first videos though was Killing Time with Aaron Chase. And it was a super rad video that was just had that raw feel because it was just Aaron going around with a camera filming everything as we went on road trips, and Kyle Strait was on that road trip as well. Yeah. As a 14-year-old. We just all got in an RV and drove around the Northwest and rode all kinds of stuff. And then my first full part was Counterparts, which was Chase's next video, it has just such a good feel to it because it was that time in all of our lives when we had nothing to lose, no families, no houses, nothing else like that. And we were all just going for it, you know, which was really cool.
Yeah, that is cool. When you look back on some of that footage now, what do you think of the riding? Like, let's just, because I have it in my mind, I've literally memorized your part from Crank 6 at this point, where you're doing, it's sort of like slope style inspired segment. Yeah. But it's on the side. It's like this super long ski hill segment, basically. Where was it? Was it Leger that you did that?
Oh, yeah, that might have been. Was that? No, that was 6. Yeah, that was in Champéry, Switzerland.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
So that's where the World Cup Champéry is. And my friend Ben Walker, who went to school in Durango as well, we had some amazing times in Durango. He lived out by, what's the little town at the bottom of the valley before you start climbing up to Perg? Hermosa?
Yeah.
Yeah. So he lived there out and had some land, and we'd go out and did ridiculous stuff. Like he'd call me and say, "Hey, I got a 50-foot bungee cord. You got to cruise over." And it's a total tangent, but just hilarious story. I'm thinking about Durango now. Yeah. And he had attached it in between two trees in his yard to a rolling garbage can. Oh, and yeah. So we would straddle it like a Bronco or like a bull or something. And then the other three people would pull it back as far as they could and then let it go, and you'd rock it across the yard and probably end up head over heels crashing. And there's no video or anything of it, but it was, you know, the best times ever. Right.
Yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah. So anyway, that guy, Ben, I got in touch with him for this segment, and we built the idea was like what Siminuk did in that one shot, you know, where he goes from like dirt jump bike to slope bike to downhill bike. And they filmed it all with one thing. We didn't have the technology to film it in one shot, and I didn't want to switch bikes, but the idea was that we would go start at the top of the mountain and do trail riding and then jumps and finish with like wall rides and bigger jumps and tricks and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So I wanted to encapsulate kind of all of the types of riding that I'm into on one bike in the mountains.
Yeah.
So that was super cool.
When you look back on that, like, are you proud of the riding then, or does the style look kind of funny to you? Like, in hindsight, what are your thoughts when you look back on, you know, that's just that segment, for example, 15 years ago?
Yeah. I mean, look, I think we're all the type of people that as professional riders that nothing's ever good enough. And even at the time, you wish you could have done something better or more stylish or whatever. Especially then we were shooting on 16 millimeter film. So it was, you just only had so many takes to do something. So I mean, I can look everything that I look back, I almost don't like watching them because I wish that I could have done better or done more. But when you put yourself back in the situation, I always did my best, you know, and so you always have that balance, you know, but,
for sure.
Yeah, looking back, I mean, especially then, I was, yeah, definitely super proud of it. And we even filmed that with like the follow cam sections in there. Ben was actually following me with a motocross helmet on with a 16 millimeter camera on one side and a rock for a weight taped to the other side because it was so heavy and you had to counterweight the camera. And that was, you know, there weren't GoPros and there was no other way to have the on camera footage, which is, it's not that long ago. It makes me sound like I'm like, oh, we had wooden wheels and it was a penny farthing, you know, but it
really wasn't that long ago. And I mean, we talk about riding progressing really fast, but it's crazy how fast bikes have progressed and just all of the equipment to capture it. Like,
yeah,
the photography, all of it. It's insane how fast.
Yeah, totally. And
progresses.
But I remember, you know, when we built that segment, it was everything that I built just about was scary to hit the first time.
Yeah.
And the flip, I mean, that was like a 30 foot long jump that was 6 or 7 feet tall, literally on the side of a cliff. I mean, they had to use one of those, even seeing the way that they built it. Have you ever seen those Swiss excavators that are like spiders?
Yeah.
It has four arms and they can work with a winch on like a 80 degree slope or something like that.
Yeah.
And this guy came in and he scooped up all the turf, moved it to the side, and then found dirt and built this big jump. And I think I spent a month over there for that segment because we just went over and we put everything into building this amazing thing. And that jump was on the side of the cliff. So if I had, you know, gone sideways or whatever, you know, you're on the edge of a super steep hill. Actually, one of the shots, it wasn't even on film, but when we were riding, I slid off trail and ended up sliding and tumbling for like 100 feet down this steep Swiss hill. I mean, it was all like that big poofy grass and I got really lucky. It didn't get hurt at all. But it was on the side of a steep hill the whole way. And so, yeah, I mean, we did the best we could. And I think more than anything, I look back and think about the tricks that I learned. And I think about what I could have made for a segment at other times that I wish I had that kind of got done afterwards or whatever. And I still think like, oh, I should do it now because I can still do everything now, but I'm a lot more risk averse now because it takes so long to heal. And I'm doing all these projects kind of one after another now. And I just really don't feel like being hurt.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Yeah. So. And we'll get to some of those projects here in a minute, but, I guess another question was going to be, when did competitions come into the picture? Because so you had this cover from Pegless Grind that was a big, you know, breakthrough for you. And then it sounds like you slowly but surely kind of earned more and more parts in more significant films. And I think I remember you competed in the first ever Crankworx, right?
Yeah, so that was... Yeah, that was that following year. So we shot that photo on the rail in what it would have been September, October. And I think it came out that winter or maybe November, December, something like that. And then the following year, there were a series of contests that were like a dirt jump contest here, a street contest there, things like that, where they build like ramps and rails and stuff like that. And then that summer was the first slope style. So it was called Joyride that year. So it was the year before, 04 was the first year they called it Crankworks. 03, it was called Joyride, and it was put together by Chris Winter and Patty Kay. They've gone back to calling it Joyride now, and Patty Kay still builds the course. But that was the first big, legit mountain bike slope style. Bearclaw won that one. That was his, you know, breakout year in slope style. And I think it was, might have been the same year of his Rampage run, where he did the big Indian Air and all the stuff on there as well. Yeah. And then it was such a mixed bag then too. So I think the podium was, I think it was Bearclaw first. I think I got second. I think Richie Schley got third, and Cam McCall, I believe, got fourth.
Dang, that's awesome.
Yeah. And I had no idea how I'd do going into it, because it was like all the big dogs, all the, you know, when you say I was one of the first free riders, I feel like there were kind of two crews. There was the Northwest, like the BC crew of Schley and Wade Simmons and Chandro and all of those guys who were doing the what's called free ride. And then I got grouped in with what were kind of like the East Coast guys who were street riding and dirt jumping and more of the BMX influence things.
Yeah, that was actually, sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say it stuck around, but I think it was, and it had an impact, but I don't think it had the same, I mean, it did obviously, but it didn't, it's never felt like it had the same kind of impact that the free ride side did, because that really changed. This is what mountain biking is and what mountain biking can do. And it kind of steered mountain biking in that direction for everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. I think one thing that's interesting though is, like, without that street influence that in a lot of ways kind of resembled BMX, like that was brought to big mountain riding and created the real sort of tech, super high level, you know, trick heavy slope style, just style of riding that we see now. Like, my impression is those Northwest guys were doing, you know, big hits and throwing big airs and that sort of thing, crazy like road gaps and all the ladder bridges that have become iconic. But it was almost like the combination of the two, and slope style sort of met in the middle. And now we see, you know, whoever it is, like Nikolai Rogatkin or whoever, just like doing 1080s. And like, it just is insane that you can do that on a mountain bike, but without that influence, the tech influence, this is somewhat like BMX inspired background, like we probably wouldn't have seen any of that. Do you think that's is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, totally. And Bearclaw played a huge role in that, because he came from the Northwest. So he was doing that stuff with those guys. And then he was a pro BMXer riding in like Gravity Games and, you know, that level of stuff before he came over to mountain bikes. And so he immediately brought that stuff in and 360ing drops and that sort of thing. So he really bridged it the most. And I think what we were trying to do with Chase and Lenoski and Abbott and everyone was, we all grew up watching BMX videos more than mountain bike videos. I mean, I did grow up watching the North Shore mountain bike videos too, but I didn't have access to that. I grew up in Louisville, Kentucky, like in the Midwest, and all I had was street riding and BMX. And there are some legendary pro BMXers from Louisville as well that, that I looked up to. And so initially it was us doing BMX stuff on hardtails, because that's what we could do in between the races, and you could do it anywhere, everywhere. And I think that's part of why I got popular, because kids thought, well, I can do this. I might not have ladder bridges and North Shore stuff, or even free ride stuff, but I do have curbs and I have stairs and I have rails and I have ramps and skate parks and stuff. And then we kind of started to look at it like, well, I remember having conversations like, what are we even doing? We're just doing what the pro BMXers are doing, but not as good as them, because they're on bikes made specifically for it, you know? And so we started to think, okay, let's do this stuff, but on features that you could only do those tricks or those moves on a mountain bike on. And then it made it kind of our thing, which was really cool. And then that took off kind of everywhere as well.
Do you remember what that run looked like, your second place run from that first Crankworks?
the main thing that sticks out to me that I remember was there was a big jump at the bottom of the hill that was, I don't know, probably 20 something feet. And I'd never backflipped a jump anywhere close to that big before. And I remember John Cowan, who was in the New World Disorders and like absolute legend mountain bike dirt jumper. He was trying to backflip that jump and he kept crashing on it and he couldn't get it. And then I went through in my run and for whatever reason, I thought, you know what? I got this. Just flip slow. I can do this. And sure enough, I landed perfect. And then the course went around and off of the GLC drop, which was like the classic drop right in front of the GLC, the restaurant at the bottom of the hill at Whistler, and just did a table off of that looking back now probably wasn't even flat or whatever. But I just remember that I couldn't believe that I had flipped the biggest jump on the course and landed it and rode away. And yeah, it was that's what sticks out to me. I actually watched the other day there's a minute long recap video somewhere on the internet and I couldn't even see the rest of my run and I don't really remember, but X ups and foot cans and stuff like that. And then the big flip at the bottom of the hill, but it was like, it was that competing with, they had like a wall ride and a drop and all this other stuff. So you'd have, you know, Schley's run was probably hitting the biggest stuff and doing simpler tricks on bigger stuff. And so it was that time where it was hard to judge the free ride guys versus the mountain bike guys. Yeah. Versus the trick guys, which kind of that lasted for a while until they streamlined the course into really like one option, you know?
For sure. For sure. So that backflip was just a spur of the moment decision.
Yeah. I mean, I'd been thinking about it through the day, but I only did it in my run.
That's crazy.
Yeah. And it was, I kind of had a, throughout my career, I've always thought about stuff a lot and been very calculated with what I do. But I did have the, I think Chase used to call me contest guy because there was stuff that I would just do in my run and land it. And it was something about I could get into the, whatever the flow state or get into the zone in my run and handle that pressure and do something that I knew that I could do that I wanted to on the spot, which worked out well.
Yeah. Yeah. So at what point did you start transitioning from the competition circuit to more of what you do now, which is more content-based, adventure-oriented, project-oriented?
So that would have been, well, through even when I was competing, I tried to do film and magazine projects as much as possible because I felt like it was just part of the whole deal. I wanted to do everything. But as it got into the late 2000s, it was getting to the point where I would do my gnarliest run and it would either like qualify last spot or not qualify even. And so you're still doing gnarly stuff and putting on a good run, but the level had gotten so high by then that I was never going to win a contest again. And then I had a pretty good concussion. I think it was 10, 11. And it was a weird one because it was on a huge jump in Southern Utah filming. And I didn't have any memory loss. I wasn't knocked out or anything like that, but I had concussion symptoms for the whole rest of the year. So, you know, a week later I hit a jump and tried to do a 360 and a backflip and I land and was just so dizzy. I could barely stand up. And then I started to look into a little bit more and I had, you know, my wife was like, why are you being a jerk right now for no reason? And the more you looked into it, it's like, oh, okay, these are all concussion symptoms. And I was tired all the time and all the classic concussion symptoms. And so that was when I stopped competing and went 100% into filming. And at the same time, it was when I was switching from Haro bikes to Diamondback, who's I'm still with 10 years later, which is crazy. But I basically just sat out for a minute and thought about what am I, you know, am I trying to push the sport anymore as far as tricks and filming? And what does that do? What does that do for my sponsors? What does that do for the general public of mountain biking? What do they want to see? And I talked to my friends that I grew up riding with that worked regular jobs and just liked mountain biking. I'm like, man, what do you want to see? And thought about what I actually wanted to be doing, which all went back to trail riding and adventures and cool stuff on the bike. And obviously Hans Reyes had that model for a long time. And so that was a lot of inspiration there too. And so that was when I said, you know what, I'm just going to pitch this as my plan to Diamondback as I'm signing with them, that what I'm going to do is camping and riding bikes and bike packing and fishing and riding with my dog and stuff like that. It's more relatable to everybody that rides mountain bikes. And then all of the filming I'm doing is on a bike that they can buy, as opposed to a slope style bike or a dirt jump bike that a company might sell a couple hundred of a year. You know, I'm filming and shooting photos on the bikes that are the bread and butter of the companies. And so I'm actually doing a better job as an athlete to promote those companies and the stuff they're making that actually affects people. And it's just something relatable that maybe it's still at a different level, a higher level than what they would be doing, a bigger ride in a crazier place or whatever, but it's something that they can aspire to and say, man, that's what I want to be doing. And then they can actually see themselves doing that, as opposed to like, well, I'm never going to do a double backflip, but man, that's crazy.
Yeah. Was it scary going in that direction? Like, you were going through one of your major, I mean, your bike sponsor is one of the biggest sponsors as a bike rider, obviously. And so you were making a big transition after a bunch of years with Haro. You were hopefully moving into a new longstanding partnership, and you were potentially completely changing yourself as an athlete from a branding standpoint and just the kind of projects and content you were doing. Was it scary to try to do that rebrand as you were trying to get this new sponsor?
Yeah, absolutely. It felt like a big risk, but what did I have to lose? I didn't have another sponsor at the time because that was ending. That was right when the 08 recession was really hitting the hardest and got cut back from everybody. And that I probably made the least that next year that I made in my career, because nobody had money in the industry. But I figured, you know, push through, give it another year, see what I can do. And it ended up working out. So it was really cool. And I just put the same work ethic into it that I would with training and filming and everything else, and just tried to come up with ideas that other people weren't doing and tried to look inside as well. I've always found that when I watch too many mountain bike videos and too much other stuff, you start to doubt yourself and think everyone's better than you and everything's been done. And so I kind of tried to not watch that stuff, watch stuff outside the sport that inspires me, and really think about just what I wanted to be doing on my bike, which was just going mountain biking. And I would still dirt jump, I'd still ride downhill, I'd do everything, but you know, the meat of it was that I just wanted to go mountain biking. And you know, that's how we all grew up. You know, when I was 12, I got a mountain bike and from Kmart, and there were trails close to my house that I could just go ride to. And we didn't know we were going mountain biking. We just were riding our bikes on trails. And that's still what I love the most, is just going out for big rides, feeling that sense of adventure. So that was what I wanted to capture.
For sure. Speaking of the kind of entrepreneurial aspect, it seems like over the course of your career, you've been pretty like unusually good at bringing in brands that aren't typically associated with mountain biking and bringing them in as partners of yours. Like Bolle comes to mind. I don't really remember them having a big mountain bike presence before your relationship. How did that come about? Because, you know, it seems like obviously throughout your career, you've been a pioneer, and that's, you know, early on it was pioneering tricks and just how mountain bikes are ridden. And to an extent, you're still doing that with a lot of your adventure projects. But now I almost think of you more as a pioneer in regards to like the entrepreneurial aspect of it. And I think that's super interesting. So I'm curious how did you go about bringing some of these non-endemic sponsors into the fold? And how would you identify, you know, who you might be interested in from that standpoint?
Yeah, Bolle was a funny one. That was actually my friend Brett Vogel, who was another Durango guy. He's up in Salida now. and he was doing all of the branding and everything for Bolé. And that was another, that was along with Manitou, one of my, just the very first paying sponsors. And he approached me after I got the cover and some other stuff. And yeah, it was one of those where, okay, they're not in the industry, but they had, they also had Colin Bailey at the time, who was the downhill national champion and actually made the Minion DHF.
Oh, no way.
Which is, you know, everyone's favorite tire across the industry. And he was just, you know, legendary racer from the US as well. And it was just a cool program to be a part of. And it was, I mean, Sonny Garcia was on from surfing, and they just put together, he kind of handpicked his favorite athletes, not necessarily picking the biggest names that he could get, but ones that he saw potential in and that he knew were good people. And so that I rode for them for a long time until I went to PAC when they moved their office to Park City and ended up getting a really good relationship going with them. But yeah, that was a long run with Bolé. And then, yeah, some of the other ones with Crank, that was crazy because somehow they got a connection with Microsoft. And so we had a, you remember those Zoom? I think it was called Zune. No, Z-U-N-E. It was the Microsoft's answer to the iPod, okay, which no one even has anymore, you know? And it had video screen on it and everything. And so, yeah, our videos came on that. So when you bought one, it was just pre-programmed on this, you know, iPod that you're buying.
That's sweet.
But for Microsoft.
Huh.
Yeah, I always, anytime I can reach outside the industry, it's usually through a personal connection. You meet somebody and they're interested in, you know, action sports marketing. And then I think it's really great to, it gives us an opportunity to show mountain biking to a new group. And we know how much mountain biking has changed and really saved our lives and everyone around us. It really changes people's lives when they start riding. And so anytime that you can work with an outside sponsor, you're showing the rest of the world what we do. And then we have the opportunity to hopefully have the opportunity to tell that story of what mountain biking is to us.
Yeah, totally. You mentioned Park City a minute ago, which is where you live now, obviously, but you didn't always live there. You mentioned Durango earlier, and then I think you're on the East Coast for a while when you were a part of that big kind of street mountain bike movement, dirt jump movement. And then, I mean, that's very much where that culture was rooted and like that movement was rooted. And then it sort of seemed like you broke rank a little bit and moved back into the mountains of the Southwest. What prompted that? Cause like it, from my standpoint, just putting myself in your shoes, like if I were to move away from Durango, it would seem like a crazy, crazy move because this is the best. I'm surrounded by all the best athletes, and have a great environment to get better in. And so if I were to like pick up and move to Florida or something, everyone would be like, well, that's kind of crazy. And
right,
in some ways, like you did something similar. Like what, why did you make that move?
Yeah, I grew up in Louisville, Kentucky, and I was the only kid in my high school that mountain biked. I ended up finding a good crew in Louisville. And I also, then I went to school at Western Kentucky University in Bowling Green, and collegiate mountain biking really led me in this direction. I, funny enough, wanted to be a pro snowboarder and moved to Colorado to try and make that work. So I grew up snowboarding on a 300-foot hill in Indiana and was competing there in snowboard, big air, and border cross racing. And I still love snowboarding almost more than bikes. So as soon as I got out of college, basically moved to Durango because I'm like, well, that's the spot. Same as you, you know, you're like, Durango is the spot for mountain biking. And so I moved out there. And funny enough, it was kind of in a off time for Durango. It wasn't pro town like it was before I moved there and like it is now. It was, especially for what I was doing. I moved there to race, but Miles had stopped racing, I believe, at that point. And Missy was gone.
T Brown had that stint in Boulder where he wasn't in Durango.
Yeah, and Todd Wells was there, but I actually didn't know him when I lived there. And I was I did. I actually Todd Wells used to show up to the Dirt Jumps.
Yeah.
And he would show up on his BMX bike and just flow right through the jumps, no problem. And that's awesome. I immediately had so much respect for him for being, you know, top cross country racer and could also dirt jump, which I thought was super cool. Yeah. But yeah, so, you know, I moved to Durango to try and make it racing, ended up working out as dirt jumping and street riding. And there were very few people that did that there then. And that's when things took off. I actually lived in Telluride for a winter on the snowboard park crew there as well, which was super fun. But when things took off, it was like, okay, the other top level riders are in New Jersey. That's where Aaron Chase was. That's where Jeff Lanoski was. And then the whole Northeast was, like you said, the scene. And so I moved out there. My wife, girlfriend at the time, Megan, she moved out as well. It was as soon as she graduated from Fort Lewis. We moved to New Jersey, and we were only there for a year, actually. But it was an amazing year because the three of us, me and Nasi, just rode every day. And we'd go dig stuff, build stuff, film stuff. And it was easy for traveling because we were going to Europe for contests all the time and nonstop flights all over. So that was the spot for a year. But after a year, my wife's from Alaska, and I had always wanted to live in the mountains. And so it was like, okay, we need to get out of here. This is awesome, but where do we move? It had to be somewhere that we could fly easily from because I was traveling all the time. Durango sucks for traveling, as you know.
Yep.
Not only do you have to fly United, which is the worst, you have to connect through somewhere as yep, well.
Every time.
Yeah. So Durango was out, and we looked at Park City. We looked at Bend, Oregon, which somehow ended up being a hot spot as well now. And we looked at like Tahoe area. And the first place we visited was Park City. And we had a weekend trip to visit here. And we'd signed a lease before we flew back home to New Jersey. So we were just in. It's, you know, small mountain town, awesome snow, you know, 30 minutes from the airport, international airport. And they didn't have, it's funny, it wasn't what it is for mountain biking now. It's really grown while I've been here. But they had good trails, and they had an amazing BMX scene with Fuzzy Hall and Matt Berenger and all kinds of Mike Aitken, like some of the best pro BMXers lived here. So I was like, well, this will be good enough, easy to travel from. And then Southern Utah for filming is close as well. So going down to Green River and Hanksville and all the classic film spots. And yeah, it was a risk. And I honestly think that I paid a price with my slope style results because of moving here. Because there was no one else that was at my level riding slope style stuff. So I would be the only guy at the dirt jumps trying to learn tricks or trying to do whatever. And we had OGO, the company, they had a warehouse with a foam pit, but it was just a foam pit. So you could do stuff with the foam, but then there was nowhere really to take it. And so I probably paid a price there, but I did a lot more mountain biking, and it, I think, ultimately led me to where I'm at right now. So I don't regret the move at all. I just, you know, you're kind of like, you wish looking back, it would have been sweet to win some more big contests or, you know, do better in that regard, but I probably would have gotten hurt more too.
Yeah. So let's talk about where you are now. Put simply, you're all over the place. Like, you are still going full throttle, doing the most insane projects, just hustling as hard as ever. And it's pretty funny because when I started dating my girlfriend, Nicole, relatively recent girlfriend, you were one of the first people that came up as a mutual friend. I was like, how do you know Porter? And she's like, well, I spent 2 weeks in a tent with him in the Himalayas recently. And I was
yeah,
like, what? And so we talked all about Zanskar. I mean, that took like multiple nights of conversation when she was catching me up on that crazy story.
Oh, yeah.
We can talk about that, but I mean, you were also in Iraq recently riding your mountain bike. I guess let's start there. Why go to Iraq to race your mountain bike or ride your mountain bike? And also, like, what did you do? What was the goal? What was the project?
Yeah. So my friend Aaron Gulley, who's a mountain bike or just a journalist, he's been with Outside Forever as well as all kinds of other outlets. He had sent me a message actually, saying, I've got a line on a trip to Iraq. Let's get over there. And, I was on a big trip when he sent that email. And when I got back, my wife was like, she keeps up on my emails when I'm on a, you know, long trip somewhere. And she's like, you're not going to Iraq. And I'm like, what are you talking about? She said, you got an email saying you're going to do an adventure trip riding in Iraq. And, I'm like, well, we'll talk about it. And one of those things, just kind of put it to the side. And then, of course, I talked about it a lot with the team, and it took about a year to plan. And Dan, absolute legendary photographer, he is known for, he went to North Korea a couple of years ago on a mountain bike trip. And
what?
He's known, yeah.
Sorry, who is this?
Dan Milner.
Okay.
Yeah, look him up.
He's North Korea.
Yeah, he's incredible. So he's, he goes to all the craziest places. And yeah, so him and Aaron Gulley were working together with this guy who runs the company Secret Compass, and their whole company's program is to do adventure trips to kind of perceived crazy places. And they're perceived crazy for a reason, of course.
Iraq is top of the list there.
Right. But then you get into the nuances of it, and you're like, okay, we can actually do a safe trip here. So Kurdistan is in the northern part of Iraq. It's autonomous. They have their own security, their own militias, their own everything. They were spared from all of the conflict, or most of the conflict. And since Saddam has been gone, they have actually had a very, very safe place there. So it's, I mean, there's, you know, checkpoints everywhere, and you'll see a drone fly overhead, like, you know, that kind of drone.
I mean, we were the DJI kind of drone.
Yeah, exactly. Can't bring that one over. And so we didn't have security with us, but we had a good plan in place, and we had intelligence from US and UK special forces that were finding out information to make sure that we were safe, and
so
we had a good plan.
Time out. We already got to slow down. How did that come about? Like, how do you tee up the privilege to get special intel from US and UK special forces?
Yeah. So Tom Bodkin, who runs Secret Compass, he was special forces. And okay. So he has contacts all over the place. And like I said, that's what he does. So he ran the trip that Matt Hunter did to Afghanistan a few years back for Ant Hill, I think. And that's kind of what he does. So he'll get journalists into war zones to do, you know, war coverage, that sort of thing, provide security. And so he has intel with all those people. And it was still a tough sell for Megan. You know, we were still talking about it when we left.
I can only imagine, dude.
Yeah. And there were times on the trip when we were like, why are we here again? because things escalated when we were there. You know, we're there in a time when Trump is running the country, and he was escalating things. That's when they moved the aircraft carrier into Iran and started escalating with Iran. And, I mean, everything was pretty cool until there was a warning that went out that said all Americans must depart Iraq. But again, it was nuanced. So what that warning said was that they moved everyone from the Baghdad embassy up to Erbil, where we were in Kurdistan. So you don't see it on the news, but it's actually safer than what it sounded like. You know, I flew right in. You know, I flew to, I can't remember where I connected through Turkey or something like that, and then landed in Erbil and just walked through customs, and they stamp your passport, and I have an Iraqi stamp in my passport now. And it's
what was
just
the
like
actual,
going
what was the actual else. Riding like
it was like riding it was like going on Nicole rides, I think.
Yeah,
so a lot of hiking, yeah. A lot of the climbs were hike a bike up. It was like riding hiking trails.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. So like downhill, we could ride most of the downhills, and you're kind of monster trucking over stuff and through big rocks and that sort of thing. There were times where we were riding where there were, again, this sounds crazier than it felt at the time, but where there were minefields on either sides
great.
Of us.
Great, great.
Yeah. But they had been there since the Iran-Iraq war, you know, in the early 80s. And so they're still there, but they have them marked really well. And so this was like that spot specifically is on Mount Halgard, which is their highest peak in Iraq. And we were about 8K from the Iranian border, which is actually where the Americans were kidnapped too. Do you remember that story?
Yeah, the hikers. Yeah.
They were actually, from what we heard and could tell, they were kidnapped from they were basically tricked into Iran. They were close to the border, closer than we were, and we were aware of what happened and how to avoid that. But, you know, we were camping and we would have a hotel reservation, then change it and stay somewhere else the, you know, last second, things like that to just keep a low profile. We stayed off social media the whole time.
That's crazy, dude.
It was kind of one of those things where it's like someone says, you know, your Everesting attempt was crazy and other stuff like that. But when you work up to it and you put the work in and you do the homework, it's actually not as crazy at the time and the moment. And it was a special experience. We stayed with locals a lot of the time and they were amazing. The Kurds are known to be one of the most hospitable, helpful, friendly people. And it really was an incredible trip. And we swam in like waterfalls in like grotto looking things, you know, and we saw Neanderthal caves where they've found remains and some of the earliest human remains.
Yeah.
It was an incredible trip, really.
Yeah. Wow. What kind of content came out of that? If people want to go read or watch, where can they go check that out? Stuff from that trip.
Yeah. There's a really good article in Adventure Journal, that came out last year. That would be the best one to read. And then I still have all the footage from that. And I've been working through how I want to edit and tell that story. But I will have that video out on my YouTube channel as well. Nice. Probably sometime this winter when I don't have stuff going like kind of 1 week to the next here, you know?
For sure. Your YouTube channel is just Eric Porter, right?
Porter MTB.
Porter,
but MTB. Yeah, anything Eric Porter will find it too. But yeah, it's Porter MTB is the name of the channel.
There's a bunch of sweet stuff on there right now with your kids, which is fun.
Oh, teach thanks. Yeah, it's been really fun to do. That was another one of those just going with it moments like we've all had with this spring. All of a sudden, we can't travel anymore and we're all quarantined at home. What am I going to do? Well, let's just film what we're doing and tell that story. And it's been really cool how it's inspired a lot of people to do fun stuff with their kids, build things in their backyard. It's amazing how many people are building their own pump tracks or jumps or whatever now. And it's cool seeing all the comments too of, you know, you got me back into mountain biking, or I just got a mountain bike because I saw this video and it looked so fun. Things like that. So it's a cool way to have longer format things where Instagram is such a look what I did, or, you know, kind of, everyone keeps scrolling, right? And YouTube is such a good avenue to really tell your story, just like a podcast is. It's like those are the two longer form storytelling formats that really are connecting with people right now. So it was kind of a forced way to really commit to it. And we're all home. And I had never intended to make it a channel about my kids or whatever. But we're all here together and I'm out there digging and they're digging with me. So it was a really natural thing for how it happened, and people have really been into it. So I've kept doing stuff with them and it's been fun.
Yeah. That's super cool. All right. We got to talk about Zanskar just because people have already heard some of it from Nicole's side of the story on the podcast. This was a pretty wild adventure trip to the Indian Himalayas. And I know Nicole's side of the story, but I would love to hear your take on the story. Maybe talk about the infamous eyeball incident, just a little bit of what that harrowing trip was about.
Yeah, so that trip, I've been good friends with Karsten and Mary for a long time. They're kind of my go-to adventure partners. And we just go do big dumb rides together. We did a really fun one to Iceland where I actually had some funny health issues there too with smashing a hole in my lip, and then that got infected and Anyway, we'll stay on Sanskar for this one. But yeah, so Karsten and Mary. So Karsten is a pro skier and pro biker, but really runs it on his own terms and does side work doing like crazy stuff, like welding a high pressure nuclear reactor tank or something, just wild stuff like that, so that he can have complete control over his sports career and only do the stuff he wants to. It's like your spirit animal as a pro athlete, you know, like all of the cool stuff and none of the BS that you have to deal with in the office all the time as an athlete. So he doesn't post to social media hardly ever. And then Mary is, you know, pro skier, photographer, and awesome storyteller. And so they're just this, you know, adventure power couple, right? That can do anything. And he's like, oh yeah, Mary's good. She's up for anything. She had never been on a bikepacking trip before. And that was her first one. So 16 days in the Indian Himalaya, the most remote place, one of the most remote places in the world, actually. And then Nicole, through the Patagonia partnership, came along as well. And she's obviously can handle herself in the backcountry and was another great fit for the trip. And our goal was a 16-day traverse from town to town, but we didn't know which towns were even still there. We thought Google Maps said our first like 20 miles of trail were a road, but it wasn't. That was where we sat in a tent in the snow. And yeah, we had a food drop 8 days in. And so the plan was to get dropped off and ride to our food drop. And then basically we were riding into Central Zanskar Valley. So the only way in and out of that valley in for 7 months a year is on the frozen river, to walk up and down the frozen river. The rest of the time, it's 2 to 3 days of driving from the closest airport to get into there over a couple 17,000 foot passes.
Jeez.
It's crazy. And so we were going to do this trekking route that, to our knowledge, no one had ridden before. And it just looked like a really cool route. And Karsten and Mary had been there skiing the winter before, when, funny enough, they had no snow. And all of these trails looked like pristine, like awesome trails. That's their roads, because there are no roads into these little communities and monasteries and nunneries and communities. So they just walk in and out. And so that was the goal, was to ride those. And we budgeted, like, it was 11 miles a day. So I think it was. So it would have been super. We thought we were being very safe. And as we're driving over, starts snowing. The forecast said light rain for like a little bit. We were just on the edge of the storm. We were going to get clipped by it. And turns out it snowed for 2 days. We were tent bound, and we figured it would, much like Durango or Park City, melt off pretty quick. We're like, okay, there's no trees here. It's full sun. As soon as the sun comes out, we're good to go. And it was just, we slogged on for a week of just pushing our bikes, carrying our bikes, like fully loaded bike packing bikes. And it was cold. It was hard, but it was incredible too. And then there were sections of trail that were melted off that were just incredible, amazing, perfect single track and the dream, you know? And we saw ibex, like huge, like they're bigger than elk, you know, they're like massive animals. And then we saw every day we saw Himalayan bear footprints. We saw snow leopard footprints. We saw wolf tracks. They were all, and it was in the snow, so we knew it was fresh, right? And
damn,
all around us the whole time. There's no trees to, I'm sure Nicole told you the stories about like all of my worries. Like, I don't look at it as anything that I do as taking risks. I look at it as managing risks. So I'm always thinking about what could we see, what could happen, what might we encounter? And so I was always voicing opinions. Hey, what do you guys think about this? But yeah, it's like, you know, as someone who grew up camping, you always hang your food, and we couldn't there.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I was worried about avalanches, our first campsite, because it's just dumping and dumping. And every hour you'd wake up and your tent would be touching your face, and you'd have to, for a couple times you could knock it off. And then after a couple hours or so, then the bottom of your tent would be sealed off, because the double wall tent has that air gap at the bottom that allows air in and out. And so then you have to get up in the middle of the night when it's, you know, below freezing and dumping snow and scoop snow away. It was a crazy trip. And then one of the hardest decisions I made was turning around before the last pass into Zanskar. And I think we all think we could have made it, but our margins were so thin that if even a rolled ankle or a small injury would have been life threatening, because there's no search and rescue there. Your best option is to use your satellite device to call the Indian Army and hope that they will come pick you up, at which point you will then be arrested for using their satellite communication lines, which, being in, technically in a conflict area in Kashmir, you are right next to the Pakistani border and the Chinese border, and you're just not allowed to use satellite devices. Dude. So you couldn't just call search and rescue. You couldn't just like descend a valley to a town. You were really out there. And so we had to make the call to backtrack all 4 or 5 days of our progress to get back to a town where we had lined up there is a workaround where you can send a message from India through your InReach to the US. So we were sending messages to Mary's dad and mom, who were then sending messages back to our fixer in Leh, the little town. Mm-hmm. And so he lined up a 4-wheel drive and lined up permissions to drive over the still closed road. It was closed for like 3 weeks while we were there to come pick us up because of the snow. Yeah. And then it drove us 3 hours around to actually make it into central Zanskar, where the rest of our food was and the rest of our, you know, all the places we wanted to go. And so, yeah, then we're sitting in a car, like a tiny little truck, like smaller than a Tacoma, you know, like an older Tacoma.
Yeah.
With no suspension and bald tires. Oh, God. We got multiple flats. We had to drive through the far northern kind of Muslim area in getting into Kashmir, where it was militarized, where the Indian Army had like 10,000 troops up there with 60 caliber guns pointed at the road and checkpoints, and it was wild. And then you get over into into Zanskar, and it's this super peaceful Tibetan Buddhist valley with the coolest people and the most amazing culture ever. And so we spent the next week over there riding these trails, riding to monasteries where we'd spend the night and hang out with the monks. And I mean, yeah, it was just the coolest trip ever. And it felt like it was at a time when a special time to be there, because the whole point of that trip was to ride those trails before the roads go in, which the Indian Army is putting in roads as quick as they can for security reasons, so that they can protect that part of India that is theirs. But also it'll bring education and healthcare and supplies and things like that to the local towns, which, you know, there's that, even the locals, they would say they see both sides. They know they're going to lose their culture.
Yeah.
But they also realize that if there's a health issue, it can be solved now. Education's going to get better, but you know, the trails will go away to some extent, because the trails are the roads. And when they put roads in, why would you walk on a trail that's up and down and crazy when you could just jump in the back of a truck?
Totally. Yeah.
There was one night when we were having dinner with this family there, and it was with the queen of Dzongla, which is this crazy little town there. And they have like the old palace and everything. And this queen, I mean, Mary asked how old she is, and I feel like she said something like older than God, or I'm a God or something like that.
Yeah.
And nobody knew how old she was. She was just old, and she was still walking around with a baby on her back, and she was making bread and making all kinds of stuff and just still doing normal things. And so we're having dinner with them, and there's this TV on playing India's Got Talent, like the worst, in our opinion, you know, the worst type of show even.
Yeah.
And we're like, man, it's happening like in front of our eyes. The modernization of, you know, they walk outside and they're still tending pastures and growing everything they eat, and then they come inside and they're still cooking on a yak dung stove. So they save all the poop from the yaks, dry it out, and then that's what they put in their little wood burning stove to cook with. That's how they're cooking their dinner. But then they have this TV with Indy's Got Talent on or whatever. It was an unforgettable, amazing trip, and cold and hard, but also the highs and the lows were very far apart, you know?
Yeah. And then you had your infamous eyeball incident. You didn't come away completely unscathed.
Yeah. So after the snow, it went bluebird, and you know, I think the lowest we were the whole trip was around 13,000 feet. And so I had my two glasses to choose from were like a Cat 2 lens that's a full coverage riding glasses, and then like a Cat 3, like a darker casual frame that's kind of more just sits on the front but doesn't cover the sides and the bottom. And so I was like, oh, it's really bright out, I'll put those on. And by the time I started to feel some irritation in my eyes, it was too late because they had already been burnt. And what happens is the sun reflects off the snow and then up into your eyes. And really, we just needed Glacier glasses, which we didn't have. And so throughout that day, my eyes started hurting worse and worse. I still didn't know exactly what it was. And then by the next day, I had to have an eye patch on because I had the sensitivity was so bad to light through, I think it was my left eye, that I just couldn't use it. And it was just like, have you ever scratched your eye? You know how bad that hurts? It felt like that all the time.
Ugh.
And luckily I had eye drops, but it was super painful. And yeah, so I ended up taping, I had one eye patched so I couldn't even see out of it. And then the other, I taped my two glasses together and then taped like flanges on the sides. So I basically made my own Glacier glasses.
Yeah.
I'll send you a picture of it. I'm sure Nicole probably showed you one, right?
I think quickly. She had like 300 photos and we went through them all super quick.
Yeah.
And I think I got a glimpse of that. Yeah.
No, I'll send you a photo though. It was ridiculous looking. And then riding downhill with no depth perception is super hard and scary. So you're just going on feel and trust that you got enough miles on the bike where you can, you know how it's going to react to certain things that you're seeing on the trail. But yeah, it was scary. And then not knowing, like we had pretty limited messaging with other people and we had no internet. So we were kind of diagnosing through what we thought and then texting with people back home to see what they thought, or with, through the inReach. But,
that's crazy, dude.
Yeah, that sucked. And I think it was like 4 or 5 days and everyone would look at me funny when I'm walking around somewhere new or whatever. But
yeah.
I learned that lesson. So I don't go anywhere without dark glasses now.
Yeah. Cool. We just did like an hour 15 or more, I think. But what else? What's next? What else do you want to talk about? Or do you want to give us a little sneak peek of what's next?
Yeah, I mean, I've got a bunch of stuff that I need to just edit from some of these bigger trips that I'm really excited to dive into, but almost a little hesitant because I want to make sure to do it right and do them justice and tell the story well. But so I'm working on that as well as, for the YouTube channel, I'm putting out, videos every other week. Some of it's backyard building, some of it's adventure stuff. Some of it's this week I'm editing we had a crazy storm that knocked down 30 something trees on the trail above my house. So we went up and cleared those out with the family and did a big ride with that. So kind of promoting advocacy a little bit there. Nobody knows what's going on right now, really, right? It's we're all kind of rolling free form a little bit until we can travel and get back to normal. But in the meantime, just I'm doing a lot of bike testing as well. We have new bikes from Diamondback and new parts and that sort of thing. And just trying to inspire people to get out on bikes and make the most of it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. In a weird way, it's, I've been busier than I ever would have expected during a time like this. And I bet you're the same way. I mean, the amount of energy that's behind bike riding right now, there's so many new people getting into the sport. I was trying to help my sister track down a bike last month, and just everything is sold out. Like, you can't get bikes. Just the
yeah, energy crazy.
Behind bike riding is really wild right now. And so I hear you in that, you know, you kind of want to ride the wave, but also stay respectful of the right thing to do also in terms of travel and that sort of thing. But
yeah,
crazy,
crazy
times.
We haven't traveled at all. I really haven't left my house hardly even. I'm riding around here a lot. It's a little harder with the smoke now to do the bigger rides. We had a bunch of goals with the kids too, where they wanted to, you know, pick off these bigger rides by the end of the year. And yep. Now we're waiting on smoke a little bit. And we're talking about renting an RV for a trip so we can be self-contained and not, you know, not expose ourselves to anything traveling, and not, you know, potentially, you know, you got to look at it like, well, what if I have it and don't know it too? For so sure. Not exposing other people to it as well as you're traveling around. But it's just a weird time for sure. And then, yeah, putting a lot of time into the local trails too, which benefit, you know, not just me, but the whole community.
Yeah, good for you.
That takes a lot of time as well. Spent a couple hours on a meeting this morning about our local trail group. So
yeah,
it's good.
Cool, man. Well, I'm glad we finally got to do this. This is definitely just part one. We've got way more to cover.
Yeah, I feel like we barely touched the iceberg on a lot of stuff.
I know. Hopefully the next one will be in person. Is there anything else that you wanted to touch on?
I mean, you're going bikepacking for the first, like, a big one, right?
Yeah. You know, it's funny. So my dad was super into bikepacking for a decent number of years now. And so it's kind of always been on my radar. And then as COVID kind of settled in and I realized that it was going to be at least most of the year, I started thinking more about some of these bikepacking missions I had in the back of my mind that I figured I wouldn't get to until post racing career.
Right.
Kind of like, well, you know, this is a pretty good opportunity. I'm probably not going to be a whole lot fitter, you know, when I'm 40 than I am now. And I've got the time and started kind of getting stuff together. And over the last, I guess it was probably 3 weeks ago, I finally was kind of like, you know, there's nothing stopping me from going and doing a Colorado trail right now. And I should just go try it. So the last 3 weeks have just been like full throttle preparation. I had so much to learn, still do have so much to learn, and just the amount of like little equipment pieces to the puzzle are crazy.
Yeah.
So it's been a really fun project. I have no idea how it's going to go. I might get out there and just be like, oh God, I'm just going to try to finish this. But theoretically, I'm going to try to go fast, but who knows? It's so far out of my wheelhouse. I have no idea what's going to happen.
Yeah, it's tough to eat enough.
Yeah.
That's a big one. And then it takes time too, especially with... So for me, bikepacking started as a way to just not stop riding and have to like deal with coming home and doing all that other stuff. So it was...
That's awesome.
If I'm bikepacking, I can just stop and go fishing. If I see a sweet river, I can ride as far as I want and then stop for the night and camp and have a good time. And that's what it's always been for me. Zanskar was the biggest like mission style one where we weren't going for a time thing, but we were trying to, you know, we had a route that was somewhat ambitious. You know, got a lot more ambitious with the snow, but yeah, so I really don't have any experience with the speed style bikepacking, but I've talked to Aaron Gulley about it, who at one time he had the AZT 350 record.
Yeah, that was gnarly.
Yeah, and he was saying it took him like, I think he set the record at the time. I don't know if it stands or not, but it was like 52 hours and he slept for like 30 minutes. He ran out of water and drank bad water and got sick and then got over that. And yes, yeah, super gnarly. So yeah, you might just end up getting over it and being like, I'm just going.
One and done.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll see. I mean, we're trying to do a somewhat unusual thing and basically leave the camping gear at home and just ride hotel to hotel.
Yeah.
Because theoretically I'm maybe fit enough to do that, but there's this one leg stage.
Yeah.
Day two, from Silverton to Buena Vista where there's nothing in between. And it's 182 miles and 26,000 feet of climbing. It's the gnarliest, slowest section. So like if you average 7 miles per hour, you're killing it.
Yeah. So
it's like 26, 27 hour push.
So you're going north too.
Yeah. South to north.
Is there a difference in the record or the, I mean, there must be, right?
Yeah. So I think technically they keep two different records.
Yeah.
But the two records are only an hour apart.
Okay. Interesting. Actually,
they've stood for a while. The one from south to north was set in 2015 and then north to south was 2016.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's going to be crazy. I just don't know how the whole lack of sleep thing and the whole fueling thing is going to be. Those are my two big question marks, but
yeah. Yeah. Hopefully you get good weather though. That's the big one on that trail.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the upsides of doing it so late.
Yeah.
But obviously the downside is there's way less daylight. So honestly, I have no idea what I'm doing, but
yeah,
we'll find out.
You'll figure it out. And I mean, that's one of my favorite trips ever was we started in Durango. We took the train to Silverton.
Yeah.
And then bike packed the trail back. And it was just such a cool way to do it. And then that trail is just incredible. So I still need to go back and do the rest of the Colorado Trail just to have done it and see the rest of it.
Cool, man.
Nice. Well, thanks for having me on.
Heck yeah, it was fun. Thanks for finally doing it. Keep in touch. I'll be watching the YouTube channel. People can find you everywhere, Eric Porter or Porter MTB. So
yeah, Porter MTB on Instagram and YouTube, and that's the main ones anyway. And then I always try to do a bunch of print stuff as well. I value that a lot. And yeah, I mean, our Zanska article's in the current Mountain Flyer as well. Mary did such a great job writing that article to where I was reading it and thinking, this is like what I grew up reading that I wanted to be on. And
that's,
you know,
awesome.
Oh man. Yeah. The other coolest parts about that trip was the bridges.
Dude, some of the photos I've seen of you riding those bridges, so sketchy.
Man, it was, that was like the dream come true from growing up watching like Indiana Jones movies and stuff. I'm like, yeah. This is what I want to be doing. Like, this is adventure.
Yeah,
that's and, so sick. Yeah, these crazy, crazy bridges for sure. But they rode pretty well. And, you know, again, we looked at them and we made sure it looked pretty safe and had a good plan going into it. So everything that it's fun to do dangerous things, technically dangerous that look like it, but put the thought in them and do them safely and, you know, have the risk management plan in place.
Totally. Yeah. Like you said, it's all about managing the risk.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool, man. Say hi to your family and we'll be in touch.
Yeah, sounds good.
Thanks for doing it.
Absolutely.
Thank y'all for listening, and thank you to Manscaped for week after week being a supporter of this podcast. Manscaped has a whole slew of awesome products. Y'all have heard a lot about the Lawnmower 3.0 from me. They also have some pretty recent Shears 2.0, a recent release, super awesome nail grooming kit. It comes in this rather fancy leather-bound little pack that has a magnet closure, some nice blingy chrome on there, pretty sweet looking thing. And the actual, you know, nail files, nail trimming tools in there are super high quality too. Right in line with that quality is the Lawnmower 3.0, top of the line hair trimmer, has all the bells and whistles, but it's not just fluff. I mean, it's a hardy little unit as well. I've dropped it plenty of times in the shower. It can get wet, no problem. It'll go the distance. Highly recommend that Lawnmower 3.0. If y'all would like to try Manscaped, you can go to manscaped.com and use code PAYSON for 20% off and free shipping. Not just 20% off, but also free shipping. Get yourself, whether it be the Lawnmower 3.0, the Shears 2.0, or some of the grooming products. I use the Crop Cleanser, which is a combined hair and body wash every single day. Love it. Great quality ingredients. No weird ingredients. Smells good. I swear by that stuff. Just go to manscaped.com and use code PAYSON for 20% off and free shipping. Thanks also to Roll Massif and the Roll Massif Challenge. Roll Massif is typically a really sweet series of 8 events. Unfortunately, those had to get put on hold this year, like just about every North American event. I had a couple of them on my calendar. I was going to do the Copper Triangle, the Tour of the Moon. Unfortunately, not going to get the chance to do that this year. Absolutely, we'll be doing it next year. But instead, this year, I'm participating in the Roll Massif Challenge. It's a virtual challenge. You can do it from the comfort of your home, whether it be on Zwift. You can do it on your local roads, gravel roads, trails, whatever your cup of tea is. You can do it wherever you are. And all you do is go to rollmassif.com/challenge and upload your rides. And there's a leaderboard there. Right now, I think I'm floating around 4th or 5th on the leaderboard, which is okay. There are hundreds of people doing this, but you know, we like to be in first. So as luck would have it, I'm about to go for a really huge series of bike rides. Maybe that'll put me at the top of the leaderboard. I hope at the very least it'll put me ahead of Ali Tetrick, who's also participating, a fellow gravel racer, good friend of mine. She's killing it right now. She's in 2nd or 3rd place. But regardless of that leaderboard, I mean, maybe it's not your cup of tea to chase the absolute max miles. If you just ride 353 miles or 484 miles, which are the cumulative distances of the 8 events for their short and long courses, you're entered to win all kinds of prize drawings. So just if you sign up and participate, every single week you're in the running for pretty sweet prize drawings, bike computers, cycling kits. But if you meet those ultimate distance goals, regardless of where you end up on that leaderboard that I was just mentioning, where Ali is kicking my ass, you are eligible to win their grand prize at the end of the competition on October 31st, which is a complete bike and a bike rack. Pretty crazy. All you have to do is go to rollmassif.com/challenge, sign up, upload your rides, and use code PAYSON20 to get yourself 20% off and free registration. And once you register, there's a pretty sweet little swag bag that comes with it, with a t-shirt, cycling jersey, your choice there. Just go to rollmassif.com/challenge. That's rollmassif.com/challenge. Use code PAYSON20. Thank you to Lily McKelvin, as always, for editing and producing this show. Thanks for Eric Porter for joining us for a pretty long recording. And thank you all for listening. Thanks for leaving a rating, a review. Please leave us 5 stars, leave a comment. All that goes a long way. Hit that subscribe button, and we will talk to you next week. Thanks for listening.